Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you very much. You've dialed into David Williams' show right here. He's getting back on and getting it working.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's see.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio.
Fantastic. Please hold. We'll be able to get David here. Online. Okay, we got one line going.
This is Lisa Wolf, White Buffalo Nation, friend of David. Just wanted to say hi, let you know I'm here. Are we live?
Couldn't accept the code that I gave it. Maybe it's changed.
I think I have you routed in right now through my other phone.
You mean we're live right now?
Probably. David, this is Lisa Wolf. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Lisa.
Hi, I can hear you.
Okay, so we're ready to roll, Jason?
If you yourself call in as the host, it will be a closer...
Are you co-host? Are you in as a host? The other person? Is anyone running the studio? I used to do Blog Talk until very recently, so.
Okay, here we go. The different phones are connecting a little differently, and so David's going to call in on the guest line right here.
Okay.
Cool. Thank you for holding on. He was pulling together quite a few shows before. And he is back at it right now. So this is one of the first ones pulling together.
Yeah.
And I just gave him the same number you're calling in. And my name is Jason Brodsky. I've been helping keep the network that was first started for the Jack Hare California Cannabis Initiative. And,
oh, wonderful.
That was 5-6 years ago. And
oh, good for the, you. Thank you for doing that.
Hey, we're doing what we can to help entertain our patriots. Do we have David on the line right now?
Can you hear me?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay, it's
you two
right now. Go for it.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to do a late introduction, and I'll start. Right now, I'm going to start with playing a little song I have here, and this is a 1 minute recording from the Santa Barbara Lucidity Festival. Camp out that took place a few weeks ago, and this is Christmas Day in 2021. I am David Williams. I'm doing this first broadcast of a program to introduce the concept of the Great Planetary Peace Pilgrimage. I have developed a bit of a speech impediment, as you'll hear the difference between my voice now and when I play a couple of recordings of earlier. But what happened was in March of this year, I was laying out a calendar, 25 stakes of a calendar for the Mayan calendar display by Jose Munoz in Isla Vista. And I had been smoking very heavily tobacco, and I can only make that assumption that's the reason, because I was bending over and pounding in wooden stakes. And but whatever happened, all of a sudden I developed this speech difficulty. I can do everything else fine in terms of typing and writing and that, but I don't sound the same, and it's very difficult and slow for me to communicate verbally. So this is going to be a test to see if it's worth it to do this kind of program. I wanted to start by explaining the vision of the Great Planetary Peace Pilgrimage. I've typed it up, and if you read the introduction, you'll get the idea. But this is an idea that goes back for me to my high school days when I was an apprentice at Walt Disney Studios under the auspices of the Boy Scouts of America, where my father worked for Walt Disney Studios as an accountant. And in that venue, everybody went to lunch at the commissary, so everybody mingled with the, and that studio was thought of as a Christians, and all the other studios were thought of as Jewish people. So my dad fit into that venue and made a lot of friends, and his friends convinced Walt Disney to sponsor an explorer post for the boys 14 to 18 to learn how to make movies. So I was, when I was 13, just before I turned 14, when we went to a meeting and they talked about it all and made the plans, and we selected Explorer Post 25 as our handle. And one of the dads was a writer, one was a director, one was a this and that, all the different jobs you need to, the grips that carry things around and all that. So a mix of a couple dozen dads with their different specialties basically tutored us kids to teach us how to make movies. We met every Thursday night. My dad would drive to Burbank from Panorama City twice a week, extra, because he'd take me there and then come and pack me up. That's how important it was to him to learn this stuff. So we combined our efforts, the kids, and we wrote a script and developed a Western movie. We took turns starring in the Western movie. And then after that, we did a documentary at the Boy Scout Jamboree, aircraft carrier, and that kind of thing. My job in the movie was the prop man. You know, what's the accountant's son going to do? Well, he's going to keep track of something. So he was the prop man. But the main job of the prop man in the Western movie was to carry the shovel to pick up the horse poop. So whenever the horse would poop, they go, "Prop man," and then David would run out and clean it up. So that was my introduction to the motion picture industry. But I made I guess friends or whatever. But I was elected to the president of the Post in my last year, ending when I was 18, when I had leave. And we all learned Robert's Rules of Order, how to conduct meetings, all that kind of stuff. So basically, I was the president of a motion picture production company from 17 to age 18 at Walt Disney Studios. And then I left and continued my dream of becoming a chemist. I wanted to be a famous chemist and invent something with help people and all that. And I, during that previous years, I had been a hobbyist and had a chemistry lab and all that. But after the Boy Scout adventure, I went to college and took chemistry major and was one of the better students. I got a degree with honors. I got straight A's in all my chemistry classes. So I learned how to be an objective observer, how to do chemistry and, you know, the things that relate. But one of the teachers that I had, Dr. Nazarian, he was a really good teacher and very strict, and I had a class called quantitative analysis, where you have to not only determine what chemicals are in the unknown sample they give you, but you have to tell exactly how much. Quantitative analysis. Now, various math evolved. Now, well, I got the first A he'd ever given in a class, and I tell this all only because the last year I took an elective, my only graduate level chemistry class I took as an elective, and that was called Modern Physical Chemistry, the course that everyone hated and dreaded. But I took it to see what it was, what was like, what's happening. And the same teacher that I had for quantitative analysis, he started the class off in a shocking way by saying to us, remember, everything we've told you in our various grades so far, 4 years, has been a model of what we think is happening. And I'm here to tell you that we don't know what's happening, and we cannot ever know what's happening because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. We can only know a higher and higher probabilities that something is true. We can never know the truth. So he knocked me on my backside with that statement, because all the time I thought science, and especially chemistry, because it's very hands-on, was looking for the truth. In this first graduate level course, he made it clear that the science didn't believe the absolute nature of truth existed. That they're all confused with this guy Heisenberg and this uncertainty principle, which has been extrapolated to mean we can never know the truth. Truth is uncertain, following on Einstein, truth is relative. So that's where science, to me, went off the rails, and I didn't finish my degree. I was blown away by that teacher and what he taught, but because the rest of the course was all kinds of complex probability distribution equations, all kinds of bullshit that didn't have any relation to reality to me, especially as a chemist pouring liquids and measuring things. We used to have a saying I worked in the chemistry lab, the stock room, for 4 years, part-time, 20 hours a day, 20 hours a week when I was in college. We used to have a saying among the chemistry majors, smells, it's biology. If it doesn't work, it's physics. It moves, it's biology. If it stinks, it's chemistry. And if it doesn't work, it's physics. Because the physics experiments never worked properly. So this is my background as a scientist. When I left college, my junior year, my dad's friend got me interested in a business career because I was a real bookworm and no social graces, no friends, just powering down, trying to get all A's and that kind of stuff. And my friend's dad, childhood friend, they reconnected. He was a life insurance sales manager with a special program where college seniors could learn how to sell life insurance, and with a special program where they finance the premium. So I could collect $10 and a guy would buy insurance policies worth $300 worth of first year premium. So I would earn maybe $150 by collecting a $10 deposit from the person. And I went to the training school and all practiced my scripts and all that. I figured, hell, if I can learn chemistry, I can learn this scripts and all that, if I'll try it. So I tried it and I liked it and maybe come out of my shell and talk to people and that kind of thing. So I became the sales manager at the local office and made a career in sales and sales management of insurance and investment products. I became a chartered life underwriter, which is kind of like a CPA in the life insurance industry, where you have to take 10 two-hour exams over a period of several years to prove your competency, and you get a CLU degree, chartered life underwriter, which is, when I got it, it's a permanent degree, so I still have that, those initials. But the idea is I became an underwriter. What that means is people who underwrite a project, look out for the project, figure out all the details, and they get the financing lined up and who's going to back the whatever it is, like if it's life insurance or whatever, where they're, and they're trained and qualified to put the financing together and get the various parties to sign the agreement and underwrite the project, meaning you sign your name under the project to give it the authority that you've underwritten it. So that's the mentality I have come out of my business career. And then what happened is I got married, fell in love with a woman, a chemistry student who I was a tutor, and decided, well, she was gone on vacation to Thailand that summer, the last summer before my senior year when I went through this thing, I decided I wanted to marry her and wooed her, and because I figured out I couldn't be married because I was going to be a hardcore academic and like a monk in the lab type of thing. But when I got this revelation that it's all bullshit, I decided, okay, I'll business career, I make money, I'll get married. So I got married and had a son follow along, and that kept me out of the Vietnam War. And I had a pretty successful, you know, business career at the time, selling different things, making a few thousand dollars a month and that. But what happened is I had a project that failed, a gold deal, where I had to go bankrupt and went out of at this time I was searching what's wrong, and it turns out that we discovered that my wife had been going out on me with cheating with three different guys, one of which guy was in my face with around the house and that, and she talked her friend and make me cheat on her to make it better somehow, and all came about, the whole thing fell apart, and that's it. What 1972, early 73, where I was scratching my head, what am I going to do? I have a wife that is cheating on me. I love my son. What to do? So we, at the time, we lived, I bought a house, and we lived in Granada Hills, and I climbed up to the top of a hill behind my house, and I was I guess I was praying, but I was meditating and thinking of what to do. I had grown up as baptized in the Episcopal Church in Rhode Island as a Christian. My parents were my dad was in the Navy. He was a sharecropper's son from Mississippi. The highest point in Mississippi is a family cemetery, which I visited as a kid. But he was real poor, and his dad died young, and a pharmacist took him under his wing to teach him how to be bookkeeper. And because his dad had died. But when he had a chance, he was old enough, he went in the Navy in World War II to get out of that mess. And there he met my mom in Rhode Island at the Navy base, a church social. And they married. But she's an Episcopalian, and he's a Southern Baptist. And they decided they wanted to move to California to get away, start fresh and all that. So we as a kids, we went to a Unity Church for a year and Unitarian Church for a year. And both of them get involved with the Rosicrucian Order and headquartered in San Jose. This is people that believe they are inherited the knowledge of ancient Egypt behind the pyramids and all kinds of stuff that how the mind works. But it's a secret society, and they don't talk about it to outsiders. They studied monographs and worked their way up to, in the end, was my dad was a 33-degree. It's kind of like Masons, I think, but this Rosicrucian thing, and they had a lodge. And I remember I went to help this 14-year-old chop down the tree to build the lodge and that. But I don't know what it's all about, but I know my parents' bookcases were all full of books having to do with how the mind works, strange phenomena, psychic things and UFOs, all that stuff, Edgar Casey, psychic stuff, all the kind of books that were on my bookcase growing up with the kind that they read. Then abruptly in the 1960s, late 60s, they both dropped out of all that because they met a people whose association with the Satya Sai Baba, this holy man from India, who at that time was very little known personality. He was born in 1923 in such a rural place in India. My dad's friends from the Rosicrucian Order got hip to him, some rich people, and they went to visit him in India in the mid-60s. They had to take an ox cart to get to the village, that kind of thing. Now that so many followers, so many, they have an airport and ashram and all kinds of stuff. But he was famous for not only powerful teachings of love, and love is the answer, and the values and right and wrong and all that stuff, but he had the developed ability since he was a child to manifest material objects from thin air. The first meetings we went to in Tustin, the lady that started the first bookstore in the United States for Sai Baba was Elsie Cowan, my mom and dad's friend through the Rosicrucian Order. They built a bookstore, and we went to the dedication and all that. And she was the one who came back with an early meetings and stories. They would rent a room, and all the people would fill it and hear these stories. And she passed around gold rings, for example, that Baba had materialized directly from thin air out of that kind of stuff. I have movies of their wedding where he made a Jap Mala and beads that go around. The beads were made from a double Rudraksha. It's a kind of seed that's rare. They're double. It. And he took, I have this movie my brother had, and he produced out of thin air, he produced this for their wedding. Then he held it up, and he split it, just split the two double rooted rockshas, the whatever they call the beads that they put them, her and her husband, Walter Collin. When they first went to visit Sai Baba, Walter Collin died on a heart attack in the hospital. And he came back to life, and then he went on to continue from the Philippines to visit Sai Baba, and he told him, he revived him, and Walter Collin told him what he experienced after he died and all that kind of stuff. This is a couple who was talking about Sai Baba at the meetings we went to. So I was, as a scientist, you see, I still believed in the absolute nature of truth, even if I didn't understand it. And I did not let the teacher talk me out of it, my belief. But I know there's so weird things that go on in paranormal phenomena because I've read about it and witnessed, I read about it all my life. But the first thing that happened, thing over a little bit, but I'm emphasizing now the paranormal nature of reality and taking off with this conversation of Sai Baba's abilities, who he died in 2011 on my brother's birthday, the brother that brought me to India to meet him and spent the month and had a personal interview with in September of 1995. And I was a witness to this phenomena where he manifests things out of thin air, rings, and most commonly vibhuti every day as a sacred ash they produce. And one time when I came out of the inner meeting room, there's no place to sit, so I stopped. I was last one out, stopped at the entrance, and I was sitting next to Baba's chair, and the guy next to me was one of the, I don't know what language they speak, but Baba speaks all the languages, and speak to him is his language. And he's asked him if the ring he'd made for him was earlier in the meeting. Baba had made a ring for this guy, and I have to check my notes, but I believe the ring was a silver ring with the Shirdi Baba's likeness. Shirdi Baba is the previous incarnation of Satya Sai Baba, and he had made a ring for him, and he asked people took the ring from him and passed it around to people to look at, and then he held the ring in his hand and blew on it three times, opened his hand, and it was a different color, a gold ring with Satya Sai Baba's likeness on it with a delicate filigree afro hair. So that part was all gold filigree kind of look. And he passed that around to everybody. And we're all awestruck, and he made a emerald ring for a lady that wanted one that matched her dress with golden green and that thing. Well, anyway, when I came out of the small reading room, I couldn't find a place to sit, so I sat down next to Bob's chair, and he got up, and this guy who he had made the ring for earlier, he asked him if the ring fit okay, because sometimes, and anyway, there's a story. He says, it fits okay on the ring, their finger, I'm wearing it, but I decided, we figured that later in talking about this, because they were talking in their language, but he says, I want to wear it, the ring you changed, the new ring, I want to wear on a different finger. I want to wear it on my first finger, not my ring finger, because it apparently symbolizes something in their culture, right? So he told Baba the ring was too small because it fit his pinky, but it didn't fit his big finger. So Bob said, oh, okay. So I'm sitting there, this guy sitting next to me, his fingers, he holds his finger like a foot in front of my face. Bob takes the ring and resizes the ring, just slides it gently up, farther up, his big finger, until the ring expanded and fit his big finger. So I was that much of a close witness. Now, I'm saying this by a preface to say, I read books about Baba for many, many years before I went to India. And I didn't have a desire to go to India because desirelessness is part of the thing. But my younger brother, 14 years younger brother, had developed cancer. And he had, when I was on the Global Peace Walk in 95, he took my wife to India to meet Baba, and the next year when I was done with the walk, he wanted to take me, so I was asked to go to escort my brother, who's dying of cancer and having a hard time walking, to help him to go. So I was not my initiative to go, but I went to we spent the month of September, and twice a day we'd go to Darshan and see what happened, and he'd give a talk, or he's accept letters you offer. I remember thinking, before this, I had an experience. I want to lead into the discussion of my faith in Jesus Christ, because that's time to talk about. But so I'll back up a little bit to the part where in 1973, in early June, roughly, I was walked up top of the hill behind the place where I was living, and trying to figure out what to do with the mess of my life. And by that time, I had gotten training in handwriting analysis, and where graph analysis, you can look it up. The website is igas.com, and there's a scientific empirical study of handwriting, how you can tell personality traits from the strokes and the handwriting. And it sounds really oddball and hokey, but it's empirical. Tens of thousands of samples this guy evaluated and came up with a scheme and teaches this course. He's dead now, of course, but his courses are going on and you can learn this stuff. But, for example, all the people who have exhibited psychic abilities, they have certain traits in common. Sai Baba has those traits in common. And the Uri Geller, the famous Israeli psychic, famous for bending spoons, he has these traits. I monitored over time when I can see people's handwriting, what their trip is. But anyway, I had just been schooled in this training of personality and had an evaluation done on myself and my wife just before this revelation came out that she was cheating on me and that. And he told me, based in these traits, he detailed the various parameters of the problems my wife and I were having was the root of I was making her so fearful. He cautioned me that she might commit suicide. And so this report, I read it and took me by surprise and knocked me on my socks. But I understood from graphoanalysis, it has to do with evaluating graphs. So I could see what he meant. All the changes in the strokes in the handwriting from what you're taught depict a graph, actually a physical graph of your personality. And the changes, but most traits are habituated and some are in conflict. People that you don't get along with have conflicting traits and fears and that kind of stuff. So anyway, I'm saying that was the background. I'm scratching my head what the hell to do with my wife's situation. My son, 4-year-old son, I love very closely. And I had to think in terms of one of the traits is called self-deceit and deceit. It's the ability to fool yourself and deceive yourself. And she, as a escape mechanism, right? So she had this deceit. I had self-deceit and secretiveness, all a mix of basically our emotions were making us not tell the truth, and that was creating all these problems. So when I went to that, I call it a mountaintop, which is a little hill, but I could see the whole San Fernando Valley, and I was thinking about all this stuff and meditating on it, and what the hell to do. And all of a sudden, I felt the presence of Jesus Christ. I cannot explain it any other way. I felt his presence. I felt I was at the at that time, I was a clean-shaven guy, and but I felt like I had a long beard. I looked and I couldn't see it. It wasn't there, but I felt it. So in this frame of mind, when I had this experience, I thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to do kind of like inspired by Jesus, going to the wilderness and communing mm-hmm. with God and figuring out something. So mm-hmm. that's when I decided I was going to take a vacation and go into the desert and find myself or whatever. So I had a rented car. I had been given as a sales price for a year. And so I left my wife thinking I had enough money going on to take care of her, and I took the other car and drove off into the wilderness, headed up the highway to see what I would figure out. And then the first thing that happened the next day, by shortly after sunrise, when I'm driving along, I have the clairaudient perception of a sound. What it means is I perceive the sound, but not with my ears, because the experience was like I'm driving, and you can daydream while you're driving and all that, but it was like a switch was turned off in my mind, and I couldn't daydream about anything. All I could perceive was the sound, Torak, Torak, oh, Torak, over and over for like a long time, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. I couldn't think of anything else but the sound and then the click. The sound went away. I could think of it, but not like that. And in later years, I had been thinking when I was driving, the Vietnam War is going on and all that. I'm thinking of the idea. I wonder if in the future humanity solved the problems we're facing, or the world has gone to hell. Is the future a paradise, or is it a mess? And I thought, well, if we've worked out the problems, maybe in the future there's some something going on where a signal from the future can guide us to the solve the problems to create paradise on earth, to lead us to a good future. That's what I was thinking when the sound came. So I took the meaning of the sound to mean the name of a cybernetics program to guide humanity from where we are now to a future of paradise on earth. I took that as a religious feeling, that what that sound meant. Then later I'm studying, collaborating with a bunch of physicists, and it became apparent that in the same area, China Lake area, up of below Bishop, in that general area, there's all kinds of strange experiments going on where people perceive sounds that were projected from some technology. So I started to doubt whether my experience was real, but what happened was that experience happened on June 23rd, 1973. And when I got to Bishop, California, I stopped for directions at the Bishop Visitor Center. I was going to go camping somewhere and get my head together. And I happened to, there's a woman there who was running the place, and I asked her for directions, and she wrote those directions down, and I saw her handwriting. And I was amazed at her handwriting compared to my wife and my, I thought this woman, all of her traits line up. We should get along really well. So I waited for her to get off work, and we visited, and sure enough, we struck it off and I had a love affair, passionate love affair with her while gone from my wife. And I wrote back to what the truth of the matter was, because I got to get committed to the truth wherever it leads, wherever consequence. So she wound up moving back to the valley for me, and we stayed together a year. And then that she didn't like what I wanted to do my missions, my spiritual mission. So we split up, and I went back to do a PhD in chemical physics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, to do my thesis on unified field theory about how the mind works. So my initial equations, I felt some kind of like spirits with me. I wrote these equations, and I knew that I was on the right track, but I hadn't figured something out yet to complete these equations, complete the understanding. So, and of course, the university didn't want to hear it, because I didn't know. I paid my $50 and turned in my application. But I went around to talk to my chemistry major friends at the university who were still working years later on their degree. And they said, no, you got it wrong, David. What you got to do is you first have to go in a brown nose around all the teachers and get a sponsor. And then you get a sponsor, they'll let you in. And then they tell you after 2 years what you're going to do your thesis on. So I didn't like that. So I went happily on my way to do an intuitive quest. And that led me to meet a fellow named Jonathan Damien, who goes by Jai Damien. Now, he was a yoga teacher, and he had hosted a gathering in Ojai, a healing gathering, kind of related to the rainbow gatherings, but Jonathan was more into formal healing circles and how he could facilitate focusing the mind on healing people. So I saw his handwritten flyer about his event and was amazed at his handwriting. I got to meet this guy, some heavy-duty guy. So I went and met him and I talked him into me helping him to go to Mexico to yoga retreat in 1975. And we got busted for a handful of pot, and I was in prison for 9 months with Guadalajara State Penitentiary after I took responsibility and he got out. And there I read a book called Warriors of the Rainbow. I felt that I would spiritually led just to find this book, because it talks about all kinds of prophecies and how they're coming true in modern times and how they all tie together from different religions and different perspectives. But the bottom line is, it says the source of this knowledge is the same. And anybody can tune into the source. I was blown away because I was of the opinion that, you know, the mind, you learn more and more stuff and you get smarter and then you get a stronger mind. I had no idea that it was backwards, that you had to release and give up attachments and get to neutral before you could really clearly receive the intuition from this source. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm rambling on, but I'm trying to get back to Jesus because today is his birthday. And I went one time when I was in Isla Vista, I had an experience thinking that, you know, I mean, I'm not a Bible student, you know. I know bits and pieces and things that make sense to me and that. But one of the things I remember was that the story of the death of Jesus and the resurrection, and after he returned from the dead, there was some guy named Thomas who couldn't quite believe it was him. My friend named Thomas, the founder of the Washington, D.C. White House Peace Vigil, the anti-nuclear peace vigil, is named Thomas, and he thinks of himself as Dodding Thomas. Well, this Thomas in the Bible story, as I heard it, had to Jesus to be sure it was him.
Mm-hmm.
This mysterious, how can you not recognize somebody unless you touch them? So some way or other, I had the vision, not formally, not, you know, but I had the idea that if it's true that Jesus Christ is going to come back to present time existence on the earth, as many people believe, and somebody's going to touch him first, like Dottie and Thomas touched him first. Well, my reasoning was, if that's the case, the person who first touches Jesus when he comes back is going to be like a circuit and a completion of an event. Now, that person's mind is going to be connected to the event, just like Dottie and Thomas was to say goodbye. Somehow somebody's going to touch him when he comes back. So,
or
I
like Mary Magdalene, who was the first to see him.
Yeah, I don't know so much of the stories, but what happened is one time in Isla Vista, I had an experience made me feel that maybe I'm the person who's going to touch Jesus first when he comes back, to be that mental circuit to connect the destiny or whatever. Right? That's, maybe it's a fantasy. I don't know. a stupid fantasy of how, who the, I would think I am kind of thing. But I had to tell this story because I'm going back to my visit with the Sai Baba. And with Sai Baba, everything you think about, everything that happens is purely according to the will of God. This is a basic teaching of Islam, too. I was tutored in Islam by a friend, a knowledgeable friend, when I was 18 years old, and I was the second member of the Islamic Society who embraced Islam, the second Anglo in Los Angeles who embraced Islam after my friend Jim Waldron gave me all these teachings for years about what it means to be Islam, to surrender to peace, to surrender to the will of God. And the basic tenet in Islam is that if it happens, it happens according to the will of God. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. So in Islam, there's no such things as accidents. The Jews and Christians, they may be the accident, the blah, blah. But not in Islam strictly. If it happens, it happens the will of God. This is the same teaching as Sai Baba. And and when he says things to the group, you're supposed to recognize he's talking to you. The thing that I'm leading up to, and I didn't think of it for months after the experience, but I gave him a letter a couple of times in Darshan. I held up an envelope and gave Bob a letter. And I had worked out in the experience in Isla Vista where I would touch Jesus when he came. And it was on the little finger of my left hand. So when I offered him this letter, unusually, instead of just taking the letter out of my hand, he smacked my little finger on my left hand with his little finger. He smacked my finger. And I know that he's, I sent in my Facebook page couple of pictures and experiences that people have had about Sai Baba, that he's materialized a lot of things that relate to Jesus, photographs of him, actual photographs of Jesus at age 29. He's made a few times. He changed the black and white picture of the Shroud of Turin into a color picture and said to the woman, well, what do you want to black and white picture of him dead for? Here's a picture after the resurrection, what he looked like. And he waved his hand and made the color picture.
And then, that's my favorite picture.
And then there's all kinds of other things. I have photographs from way back when there's a named doctor, dentist, I think, in San Diego. He's died now, but he's Jack Hislop. He's famous for a lot of early stories of Baba. And one of the stories, those is of very few people. They walk to the riverside I think it was on Easter, and he said Baba picked a twig off the tree and formed it into a cross. And he said to Hyslop, "What's that?" And Hyslop said, "Well, the Swami is the cross." And then he held it, then gave it back to him. And he put the cross in his hand and blew on it four times. And that later he said he had to blow on it four times instead of three times because it was real hard, something like that. But when he opened it, his hand was a crucifix of Jesus with a wooden crucifix. And the statue was 1 7/8 inch tall, and the silver statue, and you could look at a microscope and see the hairs and the pores and the dirt and the blood, all that. And he said, "This is a statue as an instant of Jesus' death, and this reason I had it blow four times is this is some of the wood of the original cross." So I have pictures of that too. I put it out.
Wow.
And all this stuff is online. And there may, many stories. But the thing is, Satya means truth. Satya Sai Baba. People who tell stories about it have to be telling the truth. Otherwise, bad, you know. So when you read books of Baba's stories about he's materialized the different forms and different times to different people, you know they're not made up. There's something behind them, like the guy who went to India and Baba materialized the expensive watch for him, like a Rolex watch or something. And then the guy was going to go back to Britain, and he knew he had to pass customs and have some paperwork. So the next day he visited Baba, he said, "I can take this home when an airplane without, you know, something to show them." So Baba, "Oh, okay." And he pauses and he kind of waves his hand and he produces a receipt for the guy. And then the receipt was from a story that he knew. So, "Okay, nice visit. Love you, Baba. I'm going to go home. Thank you for the watch. I'm going to go home." He goes to Britain and finds the store and asks the guy about it. And he says, "Yeah, this really odd man described Baba with the orange robe and the afro here. He just wandered barefoot in my store and asked me for a receipt for this, and I gave him the receipt. I forget why. Maybe he paid him. I don't know why he get. But he walked out of the store and disappeared. All that happened momentarily while a guy was in his presence asking for the receipt. He translocated, got the receipt, brought it back and gave it." So
right.
This, many, many weird stories are like that. And the latest, I'm on the Facebook with the Uri Geller. And I have had some communications with him and all kinds of weird stuff with him. The difference between him and Sai Baba is that scientists have had to accept the reality of Uri Geller's psychic phenomena. he was published in Nature magazine in 1973 after experiments by Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff at Stanford Research Institute that documented his psychic abilities so solidly they were able to publish in Nature magazine, the Hard Science Chemistry Physics Journal, this article about psychic phenomena on October 17th, 1973. I went to my chemistry professors then and asked them about it, and they said, oh, Nature's must have gone to the dogs to writing about this kind of stuff. But that was the beginning of it. And a lot of scientists, Dr. Jack Sarfati, for example, the leading physics of consciousness guy, I've corresponded with him for a number of years before he got mad at me. And accepts the reality of Uri Geller because he's witnessed it. Well, I witnessed it in 1977 and March of 1977. I went to a conference in Santa Monica called It's All in the Mind. It was several days conference. I beat the drum and prayed outside chanting Nam Myoho Renge-kyo for a few days, and then they let me in free, and I sat in the back of the room to watch Uri Geller's performance, and I could sense what's going on in the room, almost physically, our environment. How he manipulated the consciousness to everybody's cooperation to enable him to bend a bunch of spoons that people brought up, start, stop watches that never worked, my gun running again. I witnessed this from afar on the monitor. As close as I could, I witnessed that phenomena. That was in 1977. That was before, many years before, I guess 20 years before 1997 I'm losing track of numbers. 96 less than 20 years, almost. So two times, once with Uri Geller and in spades with Sai Baba, I've witnessed this kind of unexplainable in science phenomena. But I think we can understand this and develop how to use this. That's my mission. My mission is to develop the paranormal abilities of human beings for the good. And this is a part of what my peace tools are about. I started off explaining the Great Planetary Peace Pilgrimage as a television show, and that idea is a most popular television show ever, based on the format of a moving stage in the encampment that accompanies a long distance peace walk from place to place around the world, with popular public personalities showing up for cameo appearances on their schedule to perform or speak, with international international cuisine and the kitchens at night with a bunch of walkers, the stars of the show, coming from different languages and cultures, and showing how they can get along by practicing unconditional love and using certain kind of, I call them peace tools. And then one of these peace tools is the tenting system. It's based on a tetrahedral geometry. My tetron unified field theory, tetron natural unified field theory, is the four equations I developed from 1974 to April 28th, 1977, when I get the revelation for the oneness equation, the final equation, when I realized that Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, seven syllables, first one a half beat, is the same as the Islamic prayer La ilaha illallah, with the second syllable a half beat. I just beat one time, changed the beat, pronounced the prayer La ilaha illallah. Well, the first day I walked across Santa Barbara, it turned out to be April 28th, and I realized that beyond the measurement parameters of time and space, that these two prayers, two different religions, were exactly, absolutely, identically equal. That's the absolute identity function, and I put the math behind it. That means the oneness equation. And it, by coincidence, I found later, April 28th is the anniversary of the day that Saint Nichiren first put to voice the Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, with the teaching that when it's pronounced around the world, it will bring peace. And that was this April 28th that year. Okay, I'm going back and forth, but rambling. On the tenth system for the Great Planetary Peace Pilgrimage is a tetrahedron. If you visualize a tripod with the legs connected, the tetrahedron is the simplest geometric shape. It has a triangular base and four triangular sides. That's the shape water bonds in, the shape carbon bonds in chemically. It's the simplest shape of all life. It's the basis, it's the shape that came to me in my mind dynamics meditation in 1972. And the ceiling, in the workshop of our mind that we created in our imagination, in this four-day course called Mind Dynamics. You can look it up on the Wikipedia. It's associated with the company I worked with called Holiday Magic. But Werner Erhard was, he made the EST program. He was a student of Mind Dynamics and went on to develop Leadership Dynamics and spin off his whole thing, EST thing that Sarfati was involved with. But this symbol came to me in a two-dimensional form to stand for this tetron symbol, tetrahedron with a sphere around it and a dot in the middle, is the tetron function. And the mathematical functions. That means, but when you take six tetrahedra, like six tripods, and you put them together in a circle and put the poles together in a different way, I discovered on Christmas on 1983 that it creates a two-story structure without internal poles. So it looks like a crystal-shaped teepee. We put one up at the Lucidity Festival in Santa Barbara in 2018. The Mayan calendar daykeeper, Jose Munoz, asked me to build one for his Mayan calendar dream catcher to symbolize the new calendar that started on December 21st, 2012. That calendar had 26,000-year calendar had 20 symbols, archetype symbols, and a new one, the sixth sun calendar, has 25 archetype symbols. So they were all represented with little prayer flag things with their symbols, and this structure accidentally fit exactly in the middle of the five symmetry, my sixth symmetry. I call it a tent frame, 8-foot poles, painted a rainbow colors. This I can see, send you on the internet. The picture is what was done. But I see that as a modular construction system. It's a poles with a hole in the end, and you lace the poles together in simple, rigid frame. Makes a ideal frame for a tent to put up and take down every day to move with a peace camp. That's why I thought of it, to how to make a tetrahedron combined with a bunch of with others to make a bigger tent. So what one tetrahedron is a initial cell of a human hive, and put six of them together, and I call it a six unit module. But the bottom line is, my belief for all these years, 40 years, has been that using the shape, meditate in the shape, will cause the advancement of human capabilities. If you think of Cartesian coordinates, how you usually think of space, north, south, east, and west, up and down, those are Cartesian coordinates. If you have objective reality, the Cartesian coordinates would sound like that, north, south, east, and west, up and down. If you have relative reality, then you could put those Cartesian coordinates meaning in the, if you put the graphs in the center of your body, then you go left, right, backwards, and forwards, up and down. That would be how you would describe the distance from yourself, angles and that. So my theory is a tetron theory, is that light itself, C squared and E equals MC squared, means the each individual is the center of the universe, because each individual observer is related to light in this way. It's a little complicated to grasp, but
it makes sense.
The thing is, the essence of this, Einstein says E equals MC squared. Everybody goes, okay. Then nitpicking, what does C squared mean? The problem is that C means, people think it means the speed of light, but it means more than that. It means the velocity of light. The difference between speed and velocity is direction. If I say 10 miles an hour, that's the speed. If I say 10 miles an hour north, that's the velocity. So the value of C, 186,000 miles per second. It's just a very large number, but it's a speed. In its true form, it's a velocity. Means that when you square C squared, when you square a velocity, say 10 miles an hour north, if you square that, you get 10 miles an hour north, 10 miles an hour, 10 miles squared per hour squared, north squared. What does mean, north squared? Well, they pretend that it means one. They discount and completely ignore the fact that the velocity portion of C, when you square it, it means more than one. What it means is we're connected. Each individual is connected to light, in the sense light identifies the observer. For example, how light, I'm talking to you as a chemist, how light behaves. Light reflects. You're familiar with that. A mirror. Light refracts. Refraction is like the rainbow in prisms and crystals and all. It depends on the wavelength of light and the medium. It can split out into different colors. Mm-hmm. Based on variations on the speed of one light, various wavelengths. What most people don't know, light also polarizes. And the light rays coming from the sun are spinning. And one analogy is spinning. Another analogy, as the light rays are in a planar rotation, imagine a ray of light and its wavelength, you know, goes up and down. The wavelength of the light is mixed up in coming from the sun. All the light rays are mixed up in direction. They're not going up and down. They're not going left and right. This sine wave is mixed up. But if you put a polarizing filter, you can block the light out, like Polaroid glasses, how they work. Polaroid glasses block vibrations on a certain plane. So that way, if you get two glass pieces of glass, one which only lets polarized light vertically come through, and you turn those two perpendicular, all the light is blocked. If you turn it gradually, some of the light's blocked. That's what polarized glasses about. But the interesting thing in chemistry is that polarization is a primary chemical property. If you you know Pasteur invented, Louis Pasteur invented a bunch of things. What you may know, be aware of, he discovered optical activity. Optical activity, he showed with a he took crystals after winemaking, a tartrate salt, and Pasteur noticed with his microscope the two forms of the crystal. One form had a facet on the left side, one form had a facet on the right side. And he separated painstakingly all these little crystals, separated into all the left-handed, right-hand one that was faceted. Then he dissolved them in water, and he shined polarized light through the solution. And one form of the crystal twisted the plane of polarized light to the left, and one form twisted it to the right. That's called dextrorotatory and levorotatory optical activity. If you take any chemical and you look at the model, the Tinker Toy model of the structure of the chemical, if you reflect it in a mirror, and it's the same, the mirror image is the same, there's no optical activity. But if they're different, a compound is called optically active, and it rotates the plane of this means if an optically active chemical, it always has two forms. They may be chemically identical in some respects, but they behave differently with polarized light. And for example, if you look at some of the psychedelic chemicals like LSD, for example, LSD, the name of it is D lysergic acid diethylamide. The D means dextrorotatory. So LSD has two optical enantiomers. One twists the light to the right, one twists the light to the left, and only one of them is chemically active in the body. That's the rub. You can look up the details, but I'm trying to tell you that light does more than reflect and refract. It has a polarized property. And also, I'm telling you, discovered that light identifies the earth. Observer. Light identifies the observer. So we are connected, each of us, to light. How it works, if you imagine a jet going overhead at a certain speed, I'm talking about the principle of additivity. The bottom line is, the mystery is, posed to anybody, what is the consequence of the fact that light is non-additive? Only physical property that's non-additive. What does it mean? Well, if you're driving down the street at 20 miles an hour, and somebody passes you going 40 miles an hour, looks like they're going 20 and because you're already going 20. It's that kind of thing. That's additivity. If you're driving 40 miles an hour and you hit a brick wall, this principle of additivity always works, okay? But doesn't work with light. If a jet goes over at a certain speed and it fires a strobe light ahead of it, the observer on the ground measures the same speed as the observer in the jet. They don't add. That's the mystery of the not additivity of the velocity of light. It's as a commonly known thing. All kinds of physics have stretched a way in a proportion about this. But that's the reason that light itself identifies the observer. So I can go to many details more about that, but I'm trying to finish off another 15 minutes or so of introduction to the Great Planetary Peace Pilgrimage. And I had some recordings with it, but lost track. So I've told you some of my personal positions and why what the basis of my faith in Jesus Christ is not based on faith. It's based on reason and my understanding of physical properties. I have physical evidence, like the photographs and all the Baba produced. And by the way, his Satya Sai Baba says that he was his previous incarnation, Shirdi Baba, died, and 8 years later he was born, and he did all this stuff. But people thought he would live longer than he did, but because he counted years of life and lunar years, so he died a bunch of years before people thought he did. But it's expected that within 8 years after his death in 2011, that he will be born again as a third incarnation, the final of this triple avatar, as called Prema Sai Baba, means love, Prema. And we don't know who he is, where he is. If he's born 8 years later, maybe he's 3 or 4 years old somewhere in India. His general area is known. There's people grown up who are claiming to be him, all that. But Baba made a ring. One of the rings he made for Jack Hislop had an image as gold ring with a ceramic thing with the image of Shirdi Baba. But when you couldn't see it, when he made the ring, you couldn't see the face. The face was like turned sideways. And gradually over a period of years, the face on the ring changed to face the front. And you could see the image of what he looked like. The image I posted on my Facebook page that's indexed in the thing that I sent out about this program. So these are the reasons I have faith in the love of the message of love, unconditional love, as a solution to everywhere in the world. By Jesus' example, And that's what I'm trying to impart by this concept of the kingdom of Jerusalem, Israel. I started with this thing. Why I'm named David Crockett Williams Jr. My father's name and his grandfather's name, so I'm third David in the line of Davids, and I've toyed with that over time, but I recognize I'm literally a son of David. People think of reincarnation. I don't know reincarnation. I'm not saying I'm the reincarnation of anybody, but I carry the name. I carry this vibe of King David, and that's therefore what happened was I had a when Fuji Guruji came to the United States, Nichidatsu Fuji, he has a tradition in Japan I became aware of, which is they study until they're 33 years old, and that at that time they begin teaching. So Guruji, when he was approaching his 33rd year, he was all freaked out, thinking, what should I teach? I've studied all this stuff about everything religion and all, but what's my mission? Well, he went to a waterfall in Japan, and two times he fasted for 7 days without food or water or sleep, on keeping awake, but under a waterfall. How do you keep awake for 7 days, let alone not eating? Is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But the second time he did that, he had a vision, an apparition, a vision of the people, work person walking, beating a hand drum, and he recognized that as a certain bodhisattva, and that what it meant to him was he had to take up the drum and beat the drum to chant with us Namo Myo Horengi Kyo, and that's the main teaching. Walk, leave your home, walk, beat the drum. So Guruji was coming to the United States, and I was taken with this thing because he was coming in 19... to join the longest walk in early 1978. So I knew I was turning 33 years old that year in 1978. And I'd been thinking about this idea for a long time. And it's on my 33rd birthday, the ceremony when a woman that I met in 1976, that we had a marriage ceremony, a formal marriage ceremony, a private, committed to the natural law, the one law, not the law of the land, but the one law. And a part of that was a commitment to this idea of the kingdom of Jerusalem, Israel, to bring out the teachings of peace and the Jesus and all that. And she was right with me until for years after that, until she became pregnant with our youngest son, and that changed everything. So Since then, I've had to put it on the back burner. Many people, Mohawk Chief Jake Swamp, I gave him this information about my claim to the Kingdom of Jerusalem, Israel. Many years ago, I gave him thick documents explaining it all.
David?
Later, huh?
We lost you. Okay. You cut out.
Jake Swamp, agreed to come to Iraq one year. I had a plan to take a peace mission to Iraq after the Saddam hit invaded Kuwait, but before the American response, we were trying to put some peace thing together, and he agreed to go. He's the one who participated with the Tree of Peace ceremony, and we had to cancel it because the war broke out. Thomas Bunyaka, also completely aware. Bruce De Palma, his assistant, teases me because that Bruce was aware of most people from the early 70s are aware, but I dropped out promoting this concept because I got such a flack at home. What do you mean? Hard to believe, blah, blah,
right.
blah. So anyway,
it's very brave. I know, David, and it's very brave. Courage and a lot of, and you have to know to do what you're doing. It's not in your head. You know it.
Yeah, that's the certainty. We talked about this before. The uncertainty versus certainty. We all struggle about it, but now I'm next year. I'm 77 years old now. I put the bullshit behind. I have to go forward, make the most of it. And the thing I'm focusing on is the Peace Pole.
Yes.
The Peace Pole is a teaching that came to me from the Japanese monks that put the Namo Myoho Renge Kyo on a pole and put it up. And it's the symbol of the message of peace. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because 2,200 years ago, this message was accepted by King Ashoka, who conquered the entire Indian subcontinent by violent and bloody warfare. Then he scratched his head over a particularly bloody battle and became open and received the message of peace from the Buddhist monks and went on to create peace poles and peace monuments and 500 years of no war, no crime, no violence anywhere in the area following this teaching. So I was inspired by this concept of the peace pole. Then the Reverend Yamato, a Zen monk, came to the Rainbow Gathering in 1978, and he brought the idea to make a peace pole, but let everybody put their very symbols, their symbols of the message of peace on it, as well as the Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. So we did that, and various years that's been done. Most of the peace poles I worked on have worn out and been used in many a rainbow gathering, many stories I can tell, the peace pull for Jerusalem was introduced from Santa Barbara in 1994 at the mutual prophecy fulfillment. It had been planned for 3 years in Arizona, and the day we had to August 27th, we did a walk through all the camps, the peace pull procession, to introduce the global peace pull for Jerusalem as a blank log, and later add the symbols to bring it to the ceremony area where the main peace pull was there already. We'd made 1980, been to many gatherings. But that day on the 27th of August, when we went to the last tent, it was the Jesus tent. People believed in Jesus, had a huge tent. We brought 100 people to escape the rain. We ran into the tent, explained this. We want to make a peace pull for Jerusalem to stand for the message of peace. And the starting ceremony, empty log. We want to make a prayer before we go to the ceremony area. Okay, those four guys were happy. They sat down, kneeling on the heels, cradling this log among the four of them. And then the MC, it was Fantuzzi at the time, trying to figure out what to say in this occasion to bring, all kinds of hippie camps we went through, the Krishna camp and all kinds of...
Which year was this gathering, David? Which year was this?
1974. Okay. It was called Drums Around the World.
Hi, David. I just want to let you know we have 2 more minutes left on the broadcast. Keep going. It sounds really wonderful.
Do you want to do a closing prayer? Do you want to and continue? Then I mean, is this going to be every week?
Yeah, I'm going to get it together to do every week on Saturday at noon. And I want to finish this story about the peaceful for Jerusalem, because when we went there, the MC tried to figure out what to say, and he goes, I was raised a Christian, and I think of Jesus Christ as the original rebel, and he pointed his hand to the sky as he said that before he finished. As the last words were tapering out, instantly on the name of Jesus, lightning like you never believe, holes, thunder, big thunder happened, knocked a tree outside down, and nobody could talk for a couple of minutes. The four guys holding the peace pull for Jerusalem all had tears running down their face. That's another point of emphasis of the value of this teaching of the peace pull for Jerusalem, carrying the message of peace symbolized by these seven symbols, the last which we added lately. I'm so